Welcome to episode 123 of Breakout Culture and our last episode of the summer. I'm Ed Vasey, the culture editor of Country and Townhouse magazine.
And I'm Charlotte Metcalf. I'm the associate editor at Country and Townhouse. And as we're now off our annual break, we thought we'd tell you about two lovely summer excursions to be made. One to Wadston Manor in Buckinghamshire and the other to the Wild Botanic Garden of Wakehurst in Sussex, which is also home to the Millennium Seed Bank. Apart from both being well worth a visit in their own right, there's lots going on in the way of art at both places over the summer.
Yes, Wadston Manor is the Renaissance-style chateau built in Buckinghamshire by Baron Ferdinand de Rothschild in 1874 to house his art collection. It's got extensive Victorian-style gardens, a parterre and a Rococo-style aviary and woodland. It's open to the public, it's owned by the National Trust and managed by the Rothschild Foundation. There are two major artists exhibiting there this summer, Catherine Goodman and Joanna Vasconcellos. And here to tell us all about the house and what's on offer is Pippa Shirley, who is the director of Wadston Manor. Good morning, Pippa.
Good morning, Pippa. And at Wakehurst, there's a lot going on too. There's a new exhibition called Rooted, and you can still see the epic, vast art installation by Catherine Nelson. And here to tell us about both those, we're delighted to have with us Lorraine Le Courtois, Head of Public Programmes at Wakehurst. Good morning, Lorraine.
Good morning, and thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you both with us. Let's kick off with you, Pippa Shirley. Tell us a bit about what our listeners can see at Wadston. And before we get on to Catherine Goodman's exhibition, let's hear about this amazing wedding cake.
Yes, well, the wedding cake is indeed something. It's only just opened. It opened to the public on June the 18th. And it's been a project which I think it's probably fair to say has been long in the brewing. I think we started on the road to the wedding cake in 2018 or thereabouts. And it's the most extraordinary thing. I mean, by this sort of wonderful Portuguese artist, Joana Vasconcelos, who is, I think you could describe her as a Portuguese national treasure. She's one of these sort of forces of nature, really. And she's had this dream to create this extraordinary object for many, many years. And it is a sculpture and it's a building and it's an architectural folly and it's a garden pavilion. It's a kind of a mashup of all of those things made out of, it's got a steel frame and it's entirely clad in ceramic tiles, which have been made in a sort of ceramics manufactory in Lisbon. So if you think of all those wonderful buildings in Lisbon, which are kind of cloaked in ceramic, it's sort of very much in that tradition. And so it's sort of, it's rooted in her kind of ancestry in Portugal, in a sense. But it also has echoes of both kind of Baroque architecture and Rococo playfulness, but it's very, very contemporary. And it's about sort of festivity and marriage. And she describes this as a temple to love. And in a way, that's the best way to describe it, because people who've been coming to visit it just seem to come out with a huge smile on their faces, which is wonderful to see.
It's absolutely stunning. And there's over 25,000 tiles have gone into this. And it's over 12 metres high. It's huge.
Yes. I mean, it's a building. So it's got three tiers, as all good wedding cakes do. and you can go inside it. And the inside is also completely covered in ceramics of various sorts. And you could wind your way up a pair of staircases to each tier and then stand at the top where, if you're a bride, you could have your photograph taken, because this wonderful thing is going to be used for actual ceremonies as well as being a kind of a piece of sculpture and architecture for people to visit. And it's also encrusted with wonderful sculptural elements which have also been made in the same ceramics manufactory. And one of the wonderful things about it is that Joanna who's a great kind of, you know, reuser of things. A lot of her work is using very, very familiar objects like, you know, saucepans or that kind of domestic objects, and reusing them in very kind of surprising and playful ways. And so she spent weeks and weeks kind of going through the archives of the manufactory and found lots of the 19th century moulds, which they'd essentially stopped using, hadn't even really realised they still had them. And so the manufacturers had to put all of those back into production for her for this project, which was quite a challenge for them, I think, in lots of respects. We had lots of conversations about mermaids and how difficult they were to fire, because it's got a series of friezes of mermaids around the sort of the top two tiers. And there are cherubs and there are saints and there are candles, there are dolphins. The dolphins sort of spew jets of water into ceramic shells. And so it's a kind of an all-round sensory experience. It's illuminated at night. So if you visit it, you have this sort of visual and oral sort of feast of experience as you sort of look at it and walk around it. It really is the most extraordinary thing.
Who are the manufacturers? Are they British or Portuguese?
No, they're Portuguese. I think that was really, really important to Joanna. She's very much about Portuguese artistic and craft traditions. So it's a manufactory called Viuvia Lamego, which is just outside Lisbon towards Sintra.
Presumably this is permanent. I mean, it's an art piece, but it's not going to be dismantled, is it? Or is it?
No, I certainly hope not. In technical terms, we were given planning permission by the local authority for 17 years for the wedding cake. So at that point, if they insist upon it, we will have to move it, which will be an interesting prospect if that does indeed come to pass.
Watch this space. We'll be talking again in 17 years' time. But it was commissioned by Jacob Rothschild. I think I read an interview with him somewhere about his... it's a very bold step, and he wondered whether it was kind of almost too much. But one of the reasons he wanted to commission it is because it echoes the fact that Walsingham has this incredible porcelain collection.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, so it was commissioned by Lord Rothschild and the Rothschild Foundation, of which he is the chair. And yes, I mean, there are lots of points of connection, really, because, I mean, as you've said, we have a kind of a world famous collection of ceramics at Waddesdon, which is quite largely 18th century, sort of Sèvres and Meissen porcelain are the two things we're really famous for. But we also have a very important collection of earthenwares of various kinds. So there's that. But there's also just the fact that, you know, Waddesdon itself, I mean, you described it at the beginning, Ed, as a kind of Renaissance chateau. And it is a kind of a folly in and of itself. It's the most extraordinarily elaborate building, which is itself completely encrusted in sculpture and ornament and figures and masks and pinnacles. And very, very splendid architectural folly itself, really. And so having another one in its ground seems entirely appropriate. And you also mentioned the aviary, which is a sort of playful Rococo fantasy of an aviary, which is in fact still technically one of Europe's smallest zoos. We do a really important conservation breeding programme there of the birds which still live in it. So it has a very vital working function, as well as being an extraordinary thing to look at.
I love the fact you're one of the world's smallest zoos. That's so exciting.
Yes, I can add a zookeeper to my list of titles.
Turning to you now, Lorraine, can we hear a bit about Wakehurst? Because there's a lot going on there as well. Can you kick off by telling us about Catherine Nelson's amazing installation? Because it's the biggest art installation in the UK, isn't it?
Yes, we think so. I mean, it's a difficult thing to quantify, really. But so we have a 15th century mansion at Wakehurst, which is currently having its roof restored. And that means it's closed to the public for about 3 years. And we really wanted to make sure that we use this opportunity to celebrate Wakehurst and to celebrate the work that we do at Wakehurst and the diversity of Wakehurst, and not to detract from our visitor experience. And kind of art and culture sit quite at the heart of what we do, that bridge between art and science and culture. So we commissioned this piece by Catherine Nelson. It is absolutely massive. She came last summer and she took thousands, tens of thousands of photos of Wakehurst, and she went away and she has skillfully manipulated them into this piece called Planet Wakehurst, and it is an absolutely joyful celebration. Anyone who could stand in front of it and not instantly smile, it's just fabulous. People walk around the corner of the mansion and kids go wow, and everyone goes oh my gosh, there's so much colour, so much life in it. It's got elements of the wildlife here, it's got birds and fish and dragonflies and things, but also the huge array of plants and trees from all over the world that we have here in our collections at Wakehurst. And it's got a hint, I don't know if you remember last summer, it was very, very dry. And towards the end of the summer, some of the species that we have here at Wakehurst were under immense stress and they were beginning to show kind of signs of that stress. So there's that kind of hint of the encroaching climate change and those suggestions of biodiversity loss, which are all about the work that we're doing here at Wakehurst and how we're kind of fighting to combat those things in our work. So yeah, absolutely amazing piece and such fun working with Catherine as well. She's brilliant, gifted, so gifted and technically amazing, but to work at this scale in this detail, I mean, everybody has been astounded by it. The production company who have actually printed the wrap have never seen anything like it, and they were blown away by the level of detail that she was able to reproduce that. And actually, it was very, very challenging for them to get it to work, but they have, and it just looks stunning.
Because I've only seen pictures of it. I'm dying to come and see it. Is it static, or is other bits of film in it, or is it just masses?
It is currently static. But
currently,
join us for Glow Wild, which is our winter lantern trail, it will be less static as part of that. So we've been working with Catherine and with a projection artist to bring it to life for our winter lantern trail.
Ooh. Tell us about Catherine Nelson. Who is she as an artist?
She's an Australian artist. She comes from a film and TV background. She's worked on some major films, and but she's a photographer and digital artist primarily, and she creates beautiful art canvases that bring together these montages of different landscapes, and that's why she appealed to us, and that's why it has become such a wonderful partnership. And she really, really embeds herself in the landscape and the teams that she's working with. So she stayed on site here at Wakehurst. She's been back countless times and really got to know our horticultural teams, our scientist teams, and actually that's really important for us with all of the artists we work with. But Catherine has really exemplified that idea of kind of being part of Wakehurst and bringing that through into the work.
Well, before we get on to Rooted, let's go back to you now, Pippa, and tell us about Catherine Goodman's exhibition.
Oh, yes. And actually, really interesting, Lorraine, to hear you talking about your Catherine and the importance of being kind of embedded in place. Because so this is an exhibition which is by the artist Catherine Goodman, who's a founding director of the Royal Drawing School, amongst many other things, a very sort of distinguished artist in her own right. And she spent the last 12 years visiting an olive grove on the island of Corfu. And she's produced sort of new work, which is a kind of a reflection and a response to that place. I mean, she's one of these artists for whom drawing is absolutely kind of intrinsic to her practice. So she's drawn every single day, I think, for almost the whole of her life. And when she's in this olive grove, she draws and draws and draws. And the result is that she's produced a body of work which are portraits of the olive trees in a very kind of real sense. There's a frieze which is made up of seven separate canvases, but each one has a tree or a kind of a little group of a couple of trees on it, in really sort of rich, bright, intense colours. She sees colour in a really fascinating way. And I think through this process of constant looking and continual immersion, she sort of enters into the world of these trees in a really phenomenal way. And I think underpinning all of that is just this sense that nature can do wonderful things for people, that it can be a place of refuge. There's a kind of a theme running through the exhibition, which is based on the legend of Apollo and Daphne from Ovid's Metamorphoses, and this idea that, you know, this pursued nymph saved herself by turning herself into a tree to escape the clutches of Apollo. And just this sense that nature sort of supports and sustains us all, and is also, again, rather as you were saying, Lorraine, I think these themes, artists are engaging with these themes in really powerful ways at the moment. This sense that actually the whole thing might be under threat, that, you know, climate is changing, you know, these precious, precious features in our landscape and in our lives, and, you know, that support us all through, you know, their biodiversity and everything else, are kind of, they can't be taken for granted anymore. And that's something for us all to really kind of engage with. And that's one of the things that underpins the show.
She is really interesting. I've actually interviewed Catherine for this magazine, for Country and Town House. And she was talking about being in Corfu. And what was really interesting, she's obsessed with looking and looking and looking and looking, isn't she? And I think this is what they teach at the drawing school as well. And she made me, when I was talking to her, she made me look at this hydrangea that was between us. And she did make me see it completely differently. And she said that in this olive grove, she will go to the same tree, and she's been looking at the same tree for 12 years. So she really will see how the climate's affecting it. And so it's absolutely fascinating. So, and is this grove attached to the, because the Rothschilds have an estate there.
They do. And that's where it is. So, you know, she's known the family, she's known Lord Rothschild and other members of the family for many, many years. And so she's sort of embedded in their lives, and it's been a very kind of, you know, close and sort of nurturing relationship, I think, and that comes through in the paintings as well. I think you just get this very, very powerful sense of the importance of looking and slow looking, and that's what we all need in our lives at the moment. These kind of crazy lives we all lead, slow looking.
I like that. There's a book in there somewhere. Slow looking. Slow Looking, the accompanying volume to Slow Cooking.
It's fascinating, Pippa, how close the themes are and how different the works are that are coming out, but how close the themes are. And your point about slow looking, we're actually, we do research here at Wakehurst on nature connectedness. And one of the things that we are really uncovering, and it's coming out of lots of research, is that act of spending time in nature, just absorbing it, taking notice, really increases your connectedness to nature. And through that, our well-being is significantly increased. And anyone can have that experience. And one of the things we're really trying to use here is to use our artworks to create that connection for people and hopefully embed the natural world into all of our lives better and make us make different decisions about how we live our lives through that.
Before we talk about some of the other artists, tell us a bit about Wakehurst.
Wakehurst is an astounding, it's a 525-acre estate. It's run by the Royal Botanic Gardens of Kew and has been for just over 50 years now. It's home to the Millennium Seed Bank. I think Charlotte mentioned that earlier. And we have a significant number of scientists working here on seed science, on climate science, on biodiversity science, all forms of plant science. And particularly here at Wakehurst, we're doing kind of very, very micro analysis of the natural capital, the nature-based solutions around us, looking at carbon capture, looking at pollination benefits, nature connectedness benefits, hydrology benefits, that, and how the way we steward land, the way we look after the natural world, improves it for its own sake and also for us, and how, particularly how those layers work. So, I don't know, if you improve a landscape for its carbon capture, could you be decreasing its pollination benefit, or could you be decreasing its well-being benefit? And therefore, when we bring all of these different values to a landscape, how do we make sure that everything is working together? And really, I guess the kind of the hypothesis behind everything we do here is biodiversity is good. The better the biodiversity, the better it is for everything. And let's prove that, and let's see how it works and how we apply it to the landscapes we steward, to our urban landscapes, to the way we design, all of those things. So kind of our visitor attraction and our science and our art, our people, everything is really intermeshed, and we try to make sure that we're always bringing that science to life through all aspects of what we do.
And how did Wakehurst come to be in the possession of Kew?
Oh, that's a very long story. Wakehurst has always housed really important plant collections. The owners of Wakehurst, much like many other house owners in Sussex, liked to collect plants from around the world. So there was an important collection here already. And when Wakehurst was offered to the National Trust...
Who were the owners?
The most recent owners were the Price family. So it had had many owners. It's not, some stately homes have had one family kind of dynasty own it for a long period of time. Wakehurst isn't like that. It was passed around a couple of times. Its most famous owners, I suppose, were the Loder family, who were the most kind of plant collecting family that lived here. So yes, it was offered to the National Trust. They were not that keen on it. The house itself is perhaps not the best example of Elizabethan mansion. And so a deal was struck, really, at that point, whereby the National Trust took it on, but Kew have it on a long-term lease because of the importance of the plants that were already here. Kew needed and was looking for a space outside of London to house their temperate collections. Kew Gardens is of finite size, but also in London in the 50s, there was smog and there was plant health to be considered. So they were looking for a second site and a site, you know, where they could grow scientific infrastructure and things like that. And so that's when it was taken over, and it has been, it's had a long history. And just recently, I'd say in the last 10 years, maybe even slightly less, some of those thoughts, those kind of pioneering ideas that came out in the 50s are really beginning to come to fruition. It's taken quite a long time for us to really be living that scientific legacy.
Well, alongside the art. So let's hear about Rooted now.
Oh, yeah, because that's what we're here for, yeah. So Rooted is our summer programme. We're just celebrating one of our most recognisable plants, trees, as Pippa has started, has expanded already. And so the event is called Rooted. It runs from the 7th of July to the 17th of September, so a nice long summer season. And we have got 8 incredible outdoor art installations, which people will find all over the gardens. And it's a real exploratory, I'd say exhibition, I'm not sure if exhibition is quite the right word, but an opportunity to kind of push out into bits of Wakehurst that you may not have been to before, discover trees that you may not have seen before, and hopefully connect with them in different ways and brought to life through our artists. So each year we bring artists together with scientists, with horticulturalists and with the landscape, and the pieces are created very much for Wakehurst, for the situation that they're in. So this year we've got, I can't pick a favourite, actually. They're just all brilliant. And we've got a piece called The Glowing Canopies, which is by Sheila Berman. It's her largest ever individual piece of neon work. And it was an interesting step for us to consider a piece of neon in a botanic garden in the daytime. How is this all going to pull together? But it is huge. And they are an amazing explosion of colour. Again, the joy of trees is something we've really tried to pull through here. And Sheila's really bought that. And she's been inspired by trees all of her life, and has been fascinating to work with someone who sees things in a slightly different way. I suppose she's taking the complexity of the thing she's seeing. She's simplifying it down to a very simple, actually, line drawing to create the neons, but then bringing so much energy to that. So it really sits beautifully in the landscape, and it's sat in an area kind of we call the oak. So it's got that dark canopy that's really bringing the neon to life.
And it's 10 meters high, isn't it? 10 meters
high. It's 10 meters high. Yeah, it is. Wakehurst is a big landscape. So actually, we have to think about that landscape when we're thinking about the scale of pieces. And
although it's not as tall as the wedding cake, of course.
No, not as tall as the wedding cake. We've got some other pieces. So we've got Moot by Joseph Hillier. He's created 3 human heads from trees that fell during Storm Irwin up in Northumberland that he has carved. And they're just brilliant. And the way they're situated to reflect the communication between trees, this idea that trees communicate with themselves, but also with the ecosystem around them, and they provide nutrients or take nutrients or provide water within that ecosystem. So that whole communicative thing, and actually a really reflective dwell point right at the hub of our visitor experience. So you kind of come in and quite quickly you have to have a moment to think and go, oh, what does this mean, and where, who am I in this, which is really exciting. There's another piece called by a company called Little Lost Robot, which is just so joyful and playful, pretty much all made out of rope, but you can feed some fungi to a shrew and then make it poo.
you can What? Run that past us again. You can feed some fungi to
a shrew and then make it poo it out.
What?
Just so we can talk about how these things move around. What else can we do? Yeah, you can pump tree sap. And they've got some gorgeous poetry in there as well that you can just sit and observe and listen to. Yeah, oh, God, there's just so many pieces. So
there's an audio work, isn't there, that sounds rather wonderful. Tell us about that. Yeah.
So Sonic Woodland, so Hidden Orchestra, we've actually been working with Hidden Orchestra for 4 or 5 years now. They've done a couple of pieces with us and visitors absolutely love them. And so this year we sort of were, it was demanded really by visitors that we bring it back. So they've created this meditative grove, I suppose, down in the Redwoods, right down at the bottom of Waitcoast. So you have to walk quite a long way to get down there. But then we've got some lovely hammocks and you can just lie back and listen to the immersive soundscape that they've made, which is recorded sounds of the woodland at Waitcoast, combined with a really peaceful, relaxing music. It's a very, very deep experience, actually, and a lot of people spend a lot of time down there just listening to the whole ebb and flow of that piece. So yeah, that's one of my favorites, actually, although when I'm at work it's the one that I get to enjoy the least. The others I can kind of, when I'm walking around the gardens going about my day, I can see them and I can appreciate them. That one I have to just take a bit of time. I have to take 10 minutes out of my day and go and sit and actually spend the time enjoying it. But it is, yeah, a very, very calming, relaxing, oh yeah, brilliant experience.
It sounds absolutely amazing. And I'm just wondering, I mean, obviously, you know, Waddesdon was set up very differently because it was always a place to house art. But Waitcoast, for how long has it been really sort of embracing art and bringing art into the mix of what visitors can see and experience?
I'd say about 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
Really, that's not to say that nothing ever happened before. There's Waitcoast has always had a kind of cultural audience and people wanting that sort of thing. We've done quite a bit in the past, but on a bit more of an ad hoc basis, someone will have suggested something. We do now work with artists pretty much throughout our entire program, and that's been a very, very deliberate decision that we made probably 5 or 6 years ago, and it's been a bit of a slower burn than we would have liked because something happened in the middle, and yeah, it's taken a bit of time to get over it. But it's really about extending our reach, broadening our audiences, but bringing the science work to a broader public through art, and finding ways that people can culturally engage with the natural world that perhaps wouldn't have done or might not know how to be in the natural world, might not know how to walk through a meadow or what you should look for in a forest, and just trying to find ways to bring people into our work through art. And it's such a beautiful landscape. It speaks so wonderfully, and it's an access point for artists as well to the Royal Botanic Gardens of Kew, our collections, the herbarium, the ethnobotany collection, the seed bank collection. There's such rich content there that we just really want to find as many ways as we can to unlock for different audiences.
Well, can I just say, I mean, hats off to both of you, as you know, doing your jobs, because you're making these places so exciting. I mean, I want to get out of my chair now and get in the car and come and see both these places immediately. They just sound so fabulous, and I'm definitely coming this summer. What fabulous things to do.
Talking about getting Charlotte out of her chair, just in terms of logistics, can anyone just turn up, or is it better to buy tickets in advance?
For Waitcoast, anyone can just turn up, just come along. And we have, you can get your ticket on the day, but if you're a National Trust member, you can just come on in. If you are on Universal or Pension Credit, we have a £1 ticket. There's a whole sliding scale of tickets in the middle. So we do young adult tickets, all of that sort of thing. So just come on down.
And yes, and for Waddesdon, ditto for the manor and its grounds and the Catherine Goodman exhibition. We do kind of encourage people, just to, even if you're National Trust members, just to kind of to book, so we kind of have an idea of how many people we're getting on any one day. But you can absolutely just turn up. The wedding cake, you do need to book onto that via the website. Because of the kind of the logistics of getting people around it and its sort of its scale and everything else, we need to be able to kind of to manage that. So come and see the wedding cake, but make sure you book first.
Can you get married at the wedding cake?
You can get married at the wedding cake. Shall we book you in?
No. It's already married, but I'm not.
So somebody could have their wedding photos, because I've been to the top of the wedding cake. So presumably you can have your wonderful, immortal wedding photo taken at the wedding cake.
That's the very idea.
God, absolutely. I mean, it does look amazing. How many people can go in it at once?
We're sort of learning that at the moment. At the moment, we're sort of saying that the group should be sort of between sort of 20 to 30. But because we've not done very many of them, because it's only just opened, we're already thinking that we're going to kind of expand that a little bit. So we're We're flexing as we go, I think it's safe to say.
Well, it just looks absolutely wonderful. I'm looking at a picture of it here now. I mean, it just does look really, stunning. I mean, just
it's really
so
stunning. I really want to come down and see you, Pippa, and talk about all the things you're up to. It sounds like there's a lot of synergies we should discuss.
Well, do you know, I was thinking that too, so I'll come and see
this
you.
This is what this podcast is all about, bringing people together.
Well, no, well, congratulations to both of you. I mean, what fabulous things you're offering all of us to do this summer. And thank you both so much for coming on and telling us about it.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having us.
That's all we've got time for this week. And that was our last podcast of the summer. We'll be back on air on the 8th of September. But meanwhile, we hope you've enjoyed listening to us and we look forward to being back in the autumn. Have a lovely summer.